the largest foreign bribery scandal in history, taking out invasive species, and a trip back in time in the Keys. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. A massive multi-year investigation uncovered hundreds of millions of dollars in bribery schemes with Latin American governments centered around the construction company Odebrecht. We'll speak with the investigative reporter behind the piece. Plus, invasive species like Burmese pythons and boa constrictors are causing massive damage in the Everglades. Are the volunteer programs to hunt these snakes working? Could tracking devices become a part of the solution? Finally, Kay Wilkinson spent years of documenting life in Key Largo during the 1930s. It's part of her memoir. Her photos have come to life in a new exhibition at the Florida Keys History and Discovery Center in Isla Mirada, and we'll check them out. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, today we're going to look at a story of corruption and bribery in Latin America that is unfounded. It's the story of Odebrecht, the largest construction company in Latin America. It's at the center of a multi-million dollar bribery scandal that has sent presidents to prison and even has one former president trying to avoid extradition. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, along with the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald, have uncovered the extensiveness of bribery and corruption in numerous countries. We're joined now by the lead reporter on this story for the consortium, Sasha Chavkin. Sasha, thanks so much for joining us today.
Good to be with you, Luis.
Let's start with this. First, describe Odebrecht. I mean, this, again, it was at least the largest construction company throughout Latin America. How did it get that big? Tell me a little bit about the history.
So Odebrecht started in the 1940s, and it was a family-run business based in Salvador do Bahia in Brazil. And it started with a founder who kept the leadership within the Odebrecht family line. And the CEO at the time that most of the bribery unveiled was Marcelo Odebrecht. They had their hands in all kinds of construction projects, primarily for governments around Latin America, everything from power plants to roads to agriculture projects, almost anything that was an infrastructure project that required a massive company to carry it out, Odebrecht was there to do it.
When did the first clues surface that something wasn't right?
Well, some of our partners in this investigation had begun investigating Odebrecht as early as 2010. But the real investigation that ultimately led to Odebrecht's downfall was called Operation Car Wash, or Lava Jato. And that began in Brazil in the year 2014. It started with prosecutors looking into money laundering at car washes and other small businesses. And eventually, that led a trail to Petrobras, which was the state-run oil company in Brazil, and then to Odebrecht and all these other massive companies that were involved in bid-rigging conspiracies where they paid bribes to win contracts from the government.
How did you start to peel back the layers of this story when you think about its scale? You think about how many countries are involved, how many hundreds of millions of dollars. Again, former presidents. I mean, this is massive. I mean, how did you begin to, unravel this story?
So our investigation was based on a leak that we obtained. Odebrecht bribed on such a massive scale that they actually had a division within the company that was dedicated to managing bribes. It was called the Division of Structured Operations. Our investigation began when an Ecuadorian reporter named Anderson Boscan contacted me and told me that he had obtained a leak of the internal files from Odebrecht's bribery division. We then went through more than 13,000 documents tracking payments, showing contracts, showing emails, showing all kinds of transactions from Odebrecht's bribery division. And we brought on a team of journalists who are members of our consortium from all across Latin America. Ultimately, there were more than 50 journalists involved in this project.
Besides Brazil, you mentioned, you know, a couple of countries, but I mean, give me an idea here. How many different countries did Odebrecht operate these bribes?
So Odebrecht admitted in a plea agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice to having paid bribes across the continent and even in countries in Africa. 12 countries were covered in that plea agreement. We worked with 10 countries, with reporters from 10 countries across Latin America, and found secret payments by Odebrecht from the Dominican Republic to Peru, to Ecuador, to Panama, all of which were payments that Odebrecht had not admitted before, even though it had reached this plea agreement with prosecutors in the United States and Brazil, and even though it was cooperating with prosecutors in numerous countries across Latin America and claimed that it had come clean and that it was admitting everything that there was to admit.
And what's the link to South Florida, especially Miami? Because there is actually a big link to where some of these people and that money is going.
Absolutely. One fascinating element of how the bribery division operated was that even though Odebrecht is a Brazilian company, they sent two of the top executives from the bribery division, guys named Fernando Migliaccio and Luis Suarez, to Miami. And in 2014 and 15, those guys lived in Miami and operated large parts of Odebrecht's bribery division from there. Odebrecht shell companies were used to buy them expensive condos in Miami. They essentially were living the high life in Miami as they were managing these bribes that were paid all across Latin America.
I think about reporters and sometimes the challenge they face in getting documents, getting information. You're trying to get information about a company from another country, and not just, again, you were working with all these reporters. What was the greatest challenge in getting your hands on all that information?
Well, I would say the challenge was making sense of the information that we did have, because it was more than 13,000 documents of this division that we knew was devoted primarily to making illegal payments. But a lot of the documents were very obscure. They would just show a list of payments from one bank account to another. One of the key documents that we had was a spreadsheet that tracked all the payments that Odebrecht's bribery division made in the year 2014. And so there are more than 600 payments on this sheet. It has the dates of the payments, the public work project that it's associated with. So it would say this payment is for the metro in Caracas or a gas pipeline in Peru or whatever the case might be. And then it even had a recipient of the payment, but the recipient was only named as a code name. And many of those code names were even quite colorful and funny. There were people codenamed Stalin and Bambi and Dracula, all these funny things that the members of the Division of Structured Operations came up with.
And that was so that they could hide from basically investigators or banks, really.
Exactly. It was so that if these records came into the hands of law enforcement or the media, both of which ended up occurring, they wouldn't necessarily know who all the people who had taken bribes were. So a lot of the investigation, both on our end and by law enforcement, is trying to figure out who these code names refer to. Who is Stalin? Who is Bambi? Who are these people who we see records of them getting hundreds of thousands, even millions of dollars but we're not sure and who the person is.
The documents, the information, were their internal employees leaking this stuff, or is just this is stuff that you were able to get your hands on later?
This was obtained by a journalist in Ecuador, Anderson Boscan, who works for an outlet called La Posta, that is a news organization in Ecuador. He obtained those from his sources in Ecuador. And essentially, we don't know the identity of the original source who provided them. And we're confident that they're authentic. They've, in fact, been publicly confirmed to be authentic by former Odebrecht employees in statements made after the investigation was published. But the source is not public information.
I'm talking with Sasha Chavkin, reporter with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. It focuses on the company Odebrecht. It's a massive multi-year investigation, including more than 50 journalists, exposing millions of dollars in bribery schemes with Latin American governments. You could see the full investigation, also the Miami Herald follow-up to the story. Go to WLRN.org. Let's take a look at one of the countries, and this is one that was, it was a big story because the former president ended up getting prison time. Let's look at Brazil. The former president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, serving a prison sentence now for the corruption scandal. Just remind us briefly of how much money Odebrecht was pumping toward da Silva and the Brazilian government, what they were doing.
Well, Odebrecht was one of the top contractors for the Brazilian government, and particularly under Lula's government, where there was a very ambitious domestic agenda, where they were building out lots of infrastructure projects. Odebrecht got a lot of contracts. The payments went to a whole range of officials in the government, from ministers to, you know, state governors, senators. The connections are extensive. Lula himself is now in prison for allegedly having taken money or having accepted renovations to his apartment that were done as a favor to him by another major state contractor called OAS. And doing that allegedly in exchange for steering official business to them.
And besides Lula, I mean, what are some of the other key arrests in this investigation so far? There was one just last week.
Yeah, so last week, the former president of Peru, Alejandro Toledo, was arrested in the United States on an extradition request from Peru. For allegedly accepting bribes from Odebrecht in order to steer construction contracts for a massive highway project towards them. And, you know, Toledo had been living abroad. He had been accused, but there had been no progress in the case for a long time.
And he's trying to avoid extradition?
That's correct. The Justice Department has arrested him. Which is a step that they had not taken previously, even though Peru had made the request. It still remains to be seen exactly how that's going to play out.
You are investigating a number of different individuals, some of them dangerous. Did you ever feel threatened in the course of your reporting, facing threats yourself?
We didn't receive any threats. I think the most serious threats are to ICIJ's members. The way we work is as a network where we have top investigative reporters in countries around the world who collaborate with us on projects like this one. So for me in Washington, D.C., it's much less of a serious security situation than for our members who are in the Dominican Republic, in Peru, in other countries where they are revealing information that the government in power right there at the time may not like. So I think that the concerns are much greater for our members who are very courageous and publish these stories about the authorities in their countries, even though they're not going anywhere, and they're not coming back to Washington, D.C. after the story comes out.
You think about the scale and the size of what Odebrecht used to be. I'm curious as to, did Odebrecht fall into that too big to fail category for a lot of years, you know, similar to the financial institutions here in the U.S. during the 2008 financial crisis? Was Odebrecht too big to fail?
I mean, it almost seemed like it was too influential to fail. And that was one thing that is so scary, and why I think Odebrecht has caused so much public outrage, that they paid people from all parties, people on every side of the political equation were getting money from Odebrecht. So it almost became that they were this untouchable part of the elite, because they had their fingers and were spreading their corruption among so many different powerful officials. So, for example, in the Dominican Republic, our investigation revealed that they paid more than $39 million in hidden payments connected to this major coal plant called Punta Catalina. Two official investigations prior to our stories found that there was no wrongdoing connected to the coal plant. A lot of people in the Dominican Republic, including some of the sources I spoke to at anti-corruption groups, say that's not about the evidence, that's about the political will to take on Odebrecht because it had such strong ties to those in power.
We've been talking with Sasha Chavkin, reporter with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. We're talking about the story of Odebrecht. Again, the largest construction company in all of Latin America, and its ties to massive bribery schemes with governments and presidents, some now in prison. You can see the full investigation and the Miami Herald follow-up. Go to WLRN.org. Sasha, thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you. It was great talking with you, Lewis.
All right, still to come, how are pheromones being used to hunt snakes in the Everglades? We're going to hear from Miami Zoo Miami coming up on Sunday. I'll learn a little bit about those pythons. That's next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Invasive snake populations in the Everglades continue to have a devastating impact on the ecosystem. Burmese pythons, North African pythons, and boa constrictors have dramatically reduced the fur-bearing population in the Everglades. Since 2007, Zoo Miami has been working with the National Park Service, the United States Geological Service, and the University of Florida to eradicate these invasive species. In recent years, they've incorporated new techniques like implementing tracking devices in captured pythons and then letting them back out in the wild. Well, joining us now is WLRN's environment reporter, Jenny Stiletovich. Jenny, always great to have you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Frank Ridgely, a wildlife veterinarian who serves as the head of the Conservation and Research Department at Zoo Miami. Frank, great to have you.
Hi, Lewis. Thanks.
Frank, let me start with you. The zoo's been involved, engaged in this invasive species removal program for a decade now. Is it working?
I think it depends on what aspect you're looking at. And we've been a partner with all these other organizations trying to better understand what these invasive snakes are doing in the habitats. First, we have to understand what they're doing before we can come up with solutions. And we're trying to find techniques where we can detect them better because they're incredibly hard. But I would say for like the Burmese python, we're far past the stage of potential eradication. You know, these are efforts more to control.
There will never be eradication.
Well, there's nothing on the horizon that we are aware of that's a good potential. But for the Burmese python, we're looking at how do we control it? How do we manage it? How do we limit its spread?
You know, Jenny, the other thing I was thinking is, you know, we have all of this effort statewide to try to get rid of this invasive species. And I know that they recently caught the 500th python, I think it was. But nobody's ever answered the question, how many are there? We don't know.
That's right, because they're so hard to
find. That's right, because they're so hard to find. Getting an estimate on the sheer number is difficult. I believe they've tried to model it out. Frank might have a better guess than me, but they've through some of this tracking effort. You know, they don't know. And I think it was like 2,000 pythons, which is just a blip. It's more.
So how do we know if we're succeeding? I guess, well, Frank just told us. I think we're at the point where we're just, there's no eradication.
Right. And the way they sort of measure the impact of pythons is what's missing from the marshes. You know, so that's how they know how far they've spread in addition to the sightings. But the python elimination and the hunting is really to draw attention. I think that's been, they've been very successful at drawing attention to it. But I think they recognize that as far as actually getting rid of the snakes, hunting them down is not the way to go.
And every single one that's removed, I mean, that does have a local impact.
That's true.
Through the life of, you know, you remove a couple hundred pythons a year. You're in the lifetime of those snakes, you're saving thousands of animals that would have been consumed.
But the other thing, too, is this, is for every one you remove, how many are replacing that one?
Yeah, that's a big question. And that's something the scientists have really struggled to try to answer for the public and for policymakers. They want to know how many are there. And they're so incredibly difficult to find in the wild that to get an accurate population number is just it's
so now
difficult.
That's this is why there's this effort to track them. Mm-hmm. And so talk about some of the tactics here, because one of them was just putting like a sensor on it so we know where it's going and what it's doing, right?
Yeah. So some of the biologists that have worked on this problem over the years in the Park Service and for University of Florida and USGS, one way to understand the snakes better, at first they wanted to put transmitters in the snakes. They do it surgically because snakes don't have necks and they don't have any way to keep anything on them externally. So you put this transmitter in a snake and then let it go to find out, okay, do they keep a home range? Are they just wanderingly aimlessly across the Everglades? Where can we find them? Do they concentrate in a certain spot where maybe we could find them easier in a certain location?
So is it difficult to put this transmitter into the snake again? Because as you said, it's not like when you're tagging a shark, you're just putting a transmitter, a small device, on the fin. You have to surgically insert it into the snake. Does that is that difficult, so you're not hurting the snake and altering the snake's behaviors and
right.
so forth?
That's kind of Zoo Miami's role. We've been a supporting role in that, in offering to do the surgeries, because we have this really wonderful veterinary staff at Zoo Miami that are experts on wildlife. So we'll do these surgeries for these biologists as part of our partnership to make sure they're done properly, because these are behavioral studies.
Right.
If you do the surgery wrong, it's going to affect the behavior, and we want to know what they're doing naturally.
Do we know how many snakes have been tagged this way?
I was trying to come up with a total number through the years, and I really don't know. I think we're probably close to 50 that we've done through the years.
What is the tagging you've done so far? What has it told you? What do we know?
So, yeah, it's given all kinds of information. We learned about how these snakes, during the breeding season, they conglomerate into what we call breeding balls, where there'll be one female and multiple males. And we've discovered what is the breeding season in Florida. And if we can track a snake during that time, we might actually be able to remove multiple snakes at the same time.
When is the breeding season for snakes?
It's usually in the fall is when this is occurring in some of these big constrictors. And so if we have a snake with a transmitter, a male, he might lead us to a female and multiple other males, and they can remove them all at once. And they don't. It's much more efficient than trying to walk across the Everglades and looking for this very cryptic species. So that's one technique we learned. We learned maybe they keep home ranges and how big those home ranges are. We tried to find out if they prefer certain things. So like the tree islands in Everglades National Park, are they in those just as much as they're in the sawgrass prairies? And now they're moving into Big Cypress National Park, and that's a whole different ecosystem. We've got prairies, we've got cypress domes, and we have the Florida panther there. So we're trying to figure out impacts on these big snakes, you know, to either the food or to the panther itself.
You know, Jenny, it seems like so many of the stories that I always keep running into, it's about the eradication. This is new to me. It's like this idea of just tracking them and trying to figure out what their behavior is. Do we know a lot? I mean, have we gathered a lot of information on that?
I mean, I think they are gathering more and more information. Frank mentioned, for instance, do the snakes gather around wading bird islands? There was new research on that. I think it was last year that found, in fact, they were starting to congregate around wading bird islands. And the thought was that maybe since they've eaten all the small mammals, they've turned their attention to wading birds now. I think some of this information, too, I know I said that hunting and the elimination just barely makes a dent in the population, but the more kind of behavioral studies that Frank and other scientists do can inform hunters, you know, so then they'll know. I think they're trying to model, like, you know, what's the right temperature when they're out and what time of day. If they can figure out, we know they come out to bask and warm up at a certain time of day when the temperature is this, then they can help hunters better find those snakes.
Frank, how has it changed the approach when it comes to coordinating volunteers, you know, hunters, volunteers, whether it's setting up traps, catching them, or tagging them? I mean, is everybody working together on this?
Yeah, there's multiple agencies, and actually it's been one of the most now cohesive programs between all the different agencies. The Park Service has been very fierce in making sure they regulate the activity in the national parks and not wanting at first for people to be going in these areas. And now they realize they need help. And they need help to eyes and ears out there, skilled people, trained people, to go out into these parks and help protect these natural resources. So they've
They just expand and add Biscayne National Park this past year? So
yeah,
early on they were a little hesitant because there's no hunting allowed in national parks, but I think they realized that that this was different. That elimination is not the same as
And same with lionfish, right? Lionfish are the same thing. They've opened that up and they're asking people to come in, please help eliminate lionfish out of the local areas. And I think that's good for locals also to take some responsibility with protecting the natural resources. They feel like they're making a difference. They're out there trying to make a difference, and they are removing some of these big snakes.
Just be careful when you go out and do it. If you're not sure what you're doing, please don't go out and try to
catch Everyone gets trained and certified before going out.
Frank Ridgely, again, is a wildlife veterinarian and serves as the head of the Conservation and Research Department at Zoo Miami. We're also talking with Jenny Stiletovich, environmental reporter for WLRN. Again, looking at these different programs in place right now to track and eradicate the invasive species in the Everglades, which, again, include the North African pythons, the Burmese pythons, and the boa constrictors. Something else too, Frank, that, and Jenny brought this up to us, and this is how I learned about it, was this other project now dealing with pheromones. All right, so help me understand how this works. And this is in understanding, again, tracking the snake, but maybe even luring it.
Yeah, this has been talked about in the scientific community for years, because once we discovered that, you know, they form these breeding aggregates at that time of year, we know there has to be some very powerful attractant. And it turns out that the female snake, when she's receptive and she sheds her skin, she lets off this powerful pheromone, this chemical attractant that the males find irresistible and will come and find her, and then the males compete for breeding. So we always thought if we could figure out what that chemical compound is, and we could use it and make the snakes come to us instead of us trying to find them in this incredibly difficult habitat, that would be a pretty good tool at helping us remove a lot of snakes at once. So haven't been able to synthetically produce this pheromone or isolate it yet. But then there's this researcher named Rocky Parker who wrote one of the best titles of a scientific paper I've ever heard. It was called How to Make a Sexy Snake. And it's a very serious scientific paper, and his research is serious, but it was a great title. And he did this with garter snakes, where he used a hormone to manipulate one of the snakes to produce this pheromone, and it was very powerful. Now, we're trying to figure out, the researchers at USGS and National Park Service are trying to figure out, can we make this happen in Burmese pythons? They're very different snakes, a garter snake and a Burmese python. They split off a long time ago in the evolutionary tree, but if we could make that happen, maybe that's another tool in the arsenal, right? Of maybe we have a transmitter snake that's also producing these pheromones, so it's just going through the Everglades collecting other snakes. It makes it more efficient. Anything we can do to make it more efficient is a great tool.
Well, and we were at the same meeting, I think it was last week, when USGS presented some early findings, and where they put the pheromone in a surgically implanted tracker, right? And then they did these, maybe you can describe this test a little bit better than I can, but the males with the pheromone tracker drew other male snakes just as much as females?
That's what, they're in the middle of a pilot study. And so, yeah, I do the surgeries for them. And so we implant a tracker and we implant these hormone implants. And some of them have hormones, some of them don't. So it's a real true like blind study. And then they're doing behavioral trials to see if it seems like it works. And so that was some of the preliminary, but they feel like they still need to find out, you know, maybe exact doses and how it works. But it looks somewhat promising.
You know, it's what I love about science. You just said it, sexy snakes. That's how you do it. You know, Jenny, we always talk about the python, but, you know, something that I had a friend in college who did have a boa constrictor when it was small. And, you know, it's just like, I don't know what he did with it. Now I'm feeling bad because he may have been one of those people who just let it out. But we don't talk about boa constrictors that much. And Frank, I want to hear from you as well. I mean, is this as big a problem as the python?
I'm going to let Frank take over this because I think my thought is that they haven't had as big an impact on natural areas. That's where all our resources and concerns usually go, into protected areas, and the boas have not quite had the same impact, right?
They're very localized. So the Burmese python got into Everglades National Park.
You know what? First, real quickly, the difference. Describe the difference.
So Burmese pythons are what old world species, we call it. So, and they're a little different. They're egg-laying large constrictor snakes. Boa constrictors are from Central and South America, and they're live-bearing snakes, or what we call ovoviviparous. And so it just looks like they give birth to live young. But they are also a very large constrictor, similar to boa, and in the same family as pythons. So that's the difference between them. Now, Burmese pythons and North African pythons were kind of on the edge of kind of the eastern Everglades, and now we're moved in. The North African pythons seem to be fairly isolated and contained. But they get all the big press, of course, because they're having huge impacts now that their population exploded. Boa constrictors are on the east coast of Miami-Dade County in some very important ecosystems like the pine rockland and the hardwood hammocks and the mangroves around there. But because they can't really go north into the urban setting or west into the neighborhoods, they've been confined to these coastal ecosystems, probably having big impacts for those preserves locally and eating probably anything they can catch. But if they continue to move south, they've been established, we think, since the 1970s. If they continue to reproduce and move south, they will reach that point where they will turn the corner down by Homestead, and they could be the next big constrictor in the middle of the Everglades.
So their efforts like to get rid of those as we do with the pythons.
Yeah.
It's all the same.
Zoo Miami launched a study a few years ago, starting in like 2012, and we did the same thing. We put trackers in. We wanted to understand how these snakes are using that habitat. There was actually some citizens who became aware, and there was a complaint, and so we said, we're part of Miami-Dade County. Let's do something. And so we took the initiative. There was only one other study of boa constrictors, and it was in Puerto Rico, and they were also invasive there. And that study found they were all up in the tops of trees, so no one could find them. And then we did a study, and we got surprised. We found out that they were mostly underground here. And so that was a big revelation for us, because whenever anyone tries to go look for them, they can't find them. And it's probably because they're all underground in these solution holes and gopher tortoise burrows.
I am feeling really bad because my friend had one in college. And we thought it was the coolest thing in the world. You know, we talked about these volunteers, and, you know, we think about one of them, for example, is this guy, Dusty Crum, and he's got his own TV show, you know. And I'm wondering, how important are these volunteers in addressing the problem?
I think keeping awareness is a huge part of it, too. Just like right now, you're saying you feel bad when you were younger.
First of all, it wasn't my snake, so I don't feel that bad. Okay.
I know, but we want people to think about that. When you go to purchase an animal like this, or if the animal gets out of control in size and management for you, you know, the last thing you should do is let them go. FWC has an amnesty program. They will accept any non-domestic exotic animal. You can surrender it, no questions asked. Just call them up and they will take it, even if you don't have the proper permits for it. surrender it to FWC, never let this stuff go in the wild, because it literally costs billions of dollars every year to fight invasives. And Miami-Dade County spends, I think, over like $3 million, you know, a year just combating this problem. And Florida is unique in it, that we say everything likes to live in Florida. But it's for the invasive species, it's true.
I want to finish with this. I'm going to come back to what you said, Frank, in that I guess we have to accept that maybe there won't be any eradication. We have to try to control this, but there won't be eradication. Jenny, let me start with you, though. What does the state say? What do state officials, different people you've talked to, say about how they rate success then? How are they going to rate success in this issue if we can't eradicate it?
I think managing them, keeping them from spreading, and trying to undo some of the damage. I mean, if we can manage them and bring down their numbers and restore some of the habitat that they've wiped out, you know, and the ecosystem that they've done so much harm to.
How do they say manage when we don't know how many there are?
Well, again, it'll be the what they call the indicator species. So if they can contain, trap, eliminate more of the snakes, and they see marsh rabbits, raccoons, small mammals coming back to the Everglades, then I think they'll say, okay, that's a sign of success.
Yeah.
And we're just there again, as Frank has said, these snakes are so hard to find. It seems like that's the stage we're still at, and all this this research into modeling their behavior, coming up with tracking devices, figuring out where they live, their habitat, how they breed, is really the forward edge of how they're going to contain them. The hunters get the attention, and that's a great thing for raising awareness and getting people involved and letting people think they're doing something to deal with the problem. But it's really all that research effort that's going to make the big difference.
Frank, real quickly, how are you going to rate success?
Jenny was right on. I think it's getting recovery of species. You can have localized effects if you're intense, like they're doing a lot in the southwest part of Florida and some local habitats that are important, and they're removing these snakes, and it's probably having a big effect on those species to be able to recover. But I think overall it's difficult. For some species like the North African python, there is a chance of eliminating that. It's on the lower part of what we call an invasion curve. At the bottom, you have a chance of getting rid of them early on, and that's why it's so important for people to not release exotic animals and also report them if they see something unusual. But once you get on this curve and you get way up into kind of where they just exponentially explode, then you move into management. And barring like a super cold winter, or maybe some new biological technique where maybe it's a custom virus in the future that only targets Burmese pythons, you know, we're limited on what we can come up with right now.
Custom virus, sexy snake. At some point, science may figure out how to handle this. Yeah. Frank Ridgely, again, wildlife veterinarian who serves as head of the Conservation and Research Department at Zoo Miami. Frank, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Jenny Stiletovich, our environment reporter here at WLRN. Jenny, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, an exhibit in Key Largo that will give you a picture of life in Key Largo back in the 1930s. Really different life. We're coming up next on Sundial. Just an empty fire. Another man on wire. Just an empty fire. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. An exhibition at the Florida Keys History and Discovery Center takes us back to the 1930s to an area of Key Largo known as Planter. The exhibit is based on the book It Had to Be You by late resident Kay Wilkinson. Her book is a collection of memories about living in a tent at the edge of the Atlantic coast in the 1930s with her husband Jack. This was the early settlement years of the Florida Keys. Now picture it, your furniture getting washed up on the shore and celebratory feast of conch and turtle. Well, the exhibition are rows of black and white photographs displayed on walls that tell this incredible story. They are absolutely beautiful photographs. Brad Bertelli is the curator of the exhibition, and he joins us now. Brad, great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
This exhibition, again, based entirely on the memories and the photos and the stories from this book, It Had to Be You, by Kay Wilkinson. Real quickly, what is the book about? How did she organize it?
Well, she, in about 1968, she sent out letters to her family and her friends who had all visited her down at Planter at the campsite there, and asked them to record their memories, to write her letters to record their memories, because she didn't want to lose touch with what she considered the best time of her life. And she was a great historian and a great lover of the community, and she wanted to record this for her grandchildren and for future generations. And so she compiled, you know, basically self-published a book back in the 1995-1996, and it was really a collection of her memories plus stories from other family members and friends who she met during her time there.
I always think about life in the Keys as just a lot more laid back and relaxed. But, you know, you look at these photographs, you know, this book takes place in the community of Planter in Key Largo. Tell us a little bit about life back then in those settling days.
Well, Planter was actually settled back in the late 1800s, 1880, 1870, 1880. And it was a farming community, which is how it got its name, was a planter, because they did a lot of planting of pineapples and tomatoes and onions. And about the turn of the century, when Flagler's Railroad came in, the community began to move away from the coastline and closer to the railroad. And the original community kind of disappeared. But in the mid-1920s, during the land boom, a new kind of group of settlers moved in and lived there. And Kay and Jack, her husband, they arrived, well, Jack first, about 1936, and they had few neighbors. Here's a great quote that she wrote: "We were living in a lean-to with no conveniences, few neighbors, lots of mosquitoes, and little else, but there was love, and that was all that mattered. But most of what they had came from the ocean. They ate conch and turtle and fish and crawfish, and they grew plants or grew and traded with neighbors for tomatoes and melons and things like that. And it was really, you know, if they wanted fresh water, they had to walk over a mile into town to get water and then walk back to their campsite."
You know, I think about some of the photographs. One in particular, this is again part of the exhibition. It's a photo of Kay and Jack, and they're sitting on a chair together. Tell us a little bit about that photo.
Well, it's a great, and these are all family photos taken, you know, back in the day. And this was most of everything they did and had at their campsite washed up from the ocean. And this was their very first piece of furniture, which was, it's a small love seat, wicker love seat, sits, you know, the picture is of them, you know, the two sitting cozily on the seat, kind of in, you know, with the mangroves as a background at the side of the ocean. And it's just, you know, they always talked about how everything they had, you know, and they were surprised at what people threw overboard and would wash on shore. And this was their very first piece of furniture, and they loved sitting out there and looking at the ocean and just, you know, enjoying the simple life that they had.
I love that. That's, where'd you get your chair? I just washed up on shore. That's, we don't shop for furniture. We wait for it to wash up. You know, you also have another one. This is a funny photograph, and it's about a couple. They're on a honeymoon and they're battling mosquitoes. Tell us about this one.
Well, there was, Jack had made a long pier, and he had, you know, made this pier, just from boards washing up or from going to old houses and that had been abandoned and kind of breaking them down and straightening the nails. And eventually this pier was like 350 feet long out into the Atlantic. And you know, about midway along the pier, they had built this little room that was screened in. And there was a friend of theirs came down on their honeymoon, and they wanted to, you know, celebrate their honeymoon. They wanted some privacy. So they spent the night in this little cabin on over the water. And they're trying to enjoy themselves on their honeymoon night, and there are so many mosquitoes coming up through the boards, and it's, you know, it's a hot summer night, and they're having to cover themselves with blankets and trying to, you know, create a tent, you know, trying to escape all these mosquitoes, which, you know, they lost their battle to the mosquitoes that night.
It's an easy thing to do. I'm talking with Brad Bertelli again. He's the curator at the Florida Keys History and Discovery Center. They have a new exhibit. It's called It Had to Be You. You can see some of the photos of the exhibition and find more details on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Brad, based on the research and people you talked to, who was Kay Wilkinson?
Kay was a really independent, strong-willed young lady when she first came down and for her entire life. But she was also a lover of the community. And still today, when you bring up the name Kay Wilkinson, in fact, there was a gentleman, an old friend of hers, who came through to see the exhibit on Saturday as I was upstairs doing something else with another exhibit. And he was just reading each panel and snickering and really enjoying himself as he remembered all these stories. And she was the kind of lady who would just sit around and tell you stories about her life and entertain you for hours. But it was more than just storytelling. She was the president of the Historical Preservation Society of the Upper Keys. There was no high school in Tavernier, in the Upper Keys, anywhere in those days. The only high school was in Key West. And she recognized the need for a high school up here. So she organized a PTA and spearheaded the efforts to get a high school, you know, somewhere other than Key West up here. It is what is now the Coral Shores School.
Because I was going to say, I mean, she played an essential role in the development of Key Largo.
Not Key Largo, Tavernier. Yeah,
Tavernier. Sorry. Okay.
Yeah, definitely. She was strong in the American Cancer Society, strong in the American Legion, strong in the Daughters of the Revolution, of the American Revolution. She was really believed in the sense of community and watched it blossom from, you know, Tavernier, you know, really began to spring up in the mid 1920s. And she, you know, watched it develop and felt really connected to it and felt this, you know, what was her favorite time of her life living in this area and wanted to give back. And she always gave back.
Is there one story about her that you collected that may be surprising to people?
This was when she was from Philadelphia, and she came down with her family and had met a man. Her friends. She came down with her two sisters and her brother and her mother, and they were living in the Coconut Grove area. And she was introduced to a young man, and they fell in love, love at first sight. And he wrote after some time, after about a year, they went back to her family, moved back to Philadelphia, And Jack sent her a letter that says, you know, if you ever want to see me again, I'm here in the Florida Keys. And she talked her mother into driving her down to the Florida Keys, where, you know, they were going to, you know, stay a couple weeks. And after a couple weeks, her mom said, okay, it's time to go. And Kay said, I'm not leaving. And every time her mom argued, you know, make an argument, she would counter with something. And eventually, you know, Kay's mom gave in and said, okay, I'll leave you here, but not until you're married. So they got into a car and drove up to Fort Lauderdale and got married. And it was just her resolve for her love and her simplicity at this. She always wanted to go camping and live camping. And they had this simple life in a tent on the side of the ocean. And it was just, she loved it. It was a simple, you know, back to Mother Nature. And she grew up not solely a woman of means, a child of means, but with a fortunate family with money, and she had the nice things in her life. So her family couldn't understand why she would go live, you know, with no fresh water and no bathroom and no electricity and no running water.
The creature comforts that we're all so used to. Finish up with this, Brad, as you were putting this together, what was the story you wanted to tell, you know, and why so important to share this history and explaining how this, you know, these communities formulated and really how they became what they are?
Well, that's pretty much the mission of what we're doing here at the Keys History and Discovery Center. Is there is, you know, the Keys are a great place to come fish and relax, but there is such a wealth of history and so many stories about how these young communities started. And we were fortunate that a friend of Kay's, Lindy Roth, had the original manuscript, and it's been out of print for a long time, and brought it to us and asked if we would, you know, do something with it. So we are going to republish it. It'll be coming out later this summer, so it's available to future generations. And as I was retyping it in and putting it together, it just struck me as what a great exhibit this would be just to show people how different things were back in those days.
Was it hard gathering the photos and get everything that you needed to make the exhibit complete?
No, I had them all. They were all right. They were all right there. I have all the original photographs from the book, or and from the time. And I had some help with the Historical Preservation Society of the Upper Keys. They had a couple of pictures that were missing. And it was just a pleasure to do. And it was just, you know, one of those things that falls in your lap and you cannot ignore it. It's such a fun, eye-opening experience to see how these people lived, no iPhones and no internet and no electricity, and just living and so joyfully living.
And again, your furniture just washes up on shore. Brad Bertelli, again, curator of the Florida Keys History and Discovery Center. The new exhibit is called It Had to Be You. You can see photos of the exhibition and find more details on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Brad, it's such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And that's our program for this Monday, July 22nd. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, the protests in Puerto Rico continuing as people are calling for the resignation of Governor Ricardo Rossello. We speak with the Miami Herald reporter who's been covering the protest movement in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Plus, there's a new requirement for Florida schools to include 6 hours of mental health education in their curriculum. And this comes out of the Parkland tragedy. How can this education be beneficial for students struggling with their own mental health? And could it be detrimental? And finally, of course, we're going to meet Miami's infamous race car driver turned pot smuggler. His story comes to life in a new podcast by the Miami Herald called Smoked. We're going to talk about that coming up tomorrow. Remember, you can always find us online, WLRN.org, or find us on social media. Our Facebook or Twitter is at WLRN Sundial. We'd love to know more about what you're thinking of the program. Don't forget, too, by the way, this is a podcast. So if in case you miss any of the show, always find us on iTunes. Look up WLRN Sundial and, subscribe. And let us know if you like it. You like it. You know you do. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.